days. Or like he'd done a lot of crying. He stared at me as if he didn't recognize me. "No," he finally said. "No, you haven't heard from her, or no, she's not okay? Where have you been?" "Oh, God," he said, turning his face down to the floor and taking a few breaths. Then he looked up at me again. "You've been here alone this whole time?"
"Here in Miss Janice's," I said. "But I'm okay. I had Colby."
This was not Ronnie the way Ronnie usually was. That Ronnie was steady, even-tempered, quiet. This Ronnie was vacant and frantic and seemed ready to bust open.
"Is there anything worth saving?" he asked. "Have you looked through?"
"Some, but no, not really." I didn't tell him about Marin's purse. He'd probably think it was unimportant anyway. "I haven't been to the other side with the bedrooms." He rubbed one hand over his chin.
I can't, he repeated to himself a couple times. "Do you want to look for anything? Clothes or anything?"
I thought about all the rain we'd had, how it had smelled out there yesterday afternoon with the May sun baking a mildewy stench into everything. I couldn't imagine that anything I had would be worth saving. But still, I nodded. I followed Ronnie outside, bringing along my backpack, inside of which I'd stuffed Marin's purse. Together we walked around the leaning front wall of the house to the side where our bedrooms used to be. To my surprise, two interior walls remained standing, one in Marin's room and one in mine. Of course, the outside walls were gone, so most of our stuff was tossed and spun and pulled out and torn. I scaled the mountain of mess to get into my room, and Ronnie walked around the interior wall to where his and Mom's room would have been. I heard some muffled exclamations and clanks and thuds as if he was pushing or kicking or throwing things out of his way. I pulled on some boards and tossed them, the way I'd done with Colby the day before. I found a couple of old CDs, some clothes that had been stuffed in the back of my dresser, and, thank God, my cell phone charger. I found some old ribbons from elementary school field competitions, but those didn't seem important to me anymore. Or at least not important enough to keep. In fact, not much of anything in my room seemed all that important anymore. Not after everything that had happened. But as I stepped over my bookshelf, which had tipped and spilled books everywhere, something shiny caught my eye. I bent to pick it up. It was a porcelain kitten, a black and white one, with great staring blue eyes and a big curvy six across its chest. I wiped the grit off it and held it up. It was in perfect condition, which seemed impossible. I'd had 16 of them, one for every birthday. Each kitten was different, each one fragile and shiny, and each holding a large number across its chest. They came in the mail, always a few days before my birthday, always in a plain manila envelope, always wrapped in the comic section of the newspaper, and with no return address. Marin never got a single one. Mom's mouth turned down at the corners every time one showed up, her face deepening into a bitter frown. I assumed they were from my father. Guilt gifts, I'd come to think of them. His way of pretending he hadn't abandoned me after all. But secretly, I loved those kittens, and hung on to a warm hope that maybe the kittens meant my father did care a little bit. Like maybe they were a secret message that he still wanted to be connected, that maybe he'd only meant to leave her, not me. Sometimes the kittens felt like the only connection I had to half of myself.
"I want a kitten,"
Marin had screeched when I'd gotten the last one.
"I want a real kitten, a gray and white one with blue eyes. Can I get a kitten, Mommy?"
My mom had rolled her eyes as, for the next 2 months, Marin had begged and begged for a kitten of her own. "Ronnie's allergic," Mom had always said. "We can't afford a kitten, and they puke in the house. Who's gonna clean up the hairballs in the litter box? Not me. And certainly not you girls." I could understand why Marin wanted a kitten of her own. I had a whole collection of them. Carefully, I set the kitten down with the CDs, then used both hands to right the bookshelf it had once been sitting on, hoping to find the others. Instead, all I found was broken porcelain, shiny pieces of trash. Six was the only survivor. I heard the wooden clonk of boards being flung on top of boards over where Ronnie was and decided I'd looked enough. I was tired and thirsty, and I wanted out of there. I stumbled over a sneaker, which set me on a frantic search for its twin. I found it a few feet away under a plastic-coated wire shelf that was normally housed in the hall bathroom. I cradled the shoes in my arms, excited for them to dry out so I could take off Ronnie's boots. Then I gathered up the clothes and the phone charger, pushed the kitten into my pocket, and headed to Ronnie. "I'm ready," I said as I rounded the wall. I didn't find much, but I trailed off when I saw my stepdad, who was squatting next to the bed, which, oddly, didn't appear to have moved an inch, his face pressed into the mattress, his hands holding something on top of it. He was crying, his whole body shaking. I took a step forward and saw what he was holding, a framed wedding photo of him and Mom. "Ronnie?" I said, but my heart had shriveled and fallen down into my toes. I knew. Right then I knew that my only miracle had been waking up to the word Jesus this morning. I knew there would be no other good news. I knew that Mom and Marin were gone. Chapter 10. On the day of the tornado, Ronnie had been delayed at work by an irate customer who wouldn't leave until she'd had her say, no matter how ominous the sky looked. Normally, this wouldn't have bothered Ronnie too much, because he understood that when you managed a hardware chain store, you didn't ever get out at the time you were supposed to get out. You got angry customers, or guys late in returning the rental flatbeds, or indecisive women who sauntered into the store 5 minutes before closing and stared at the mailbox display for half an hour. But with the sky looking so ominous, he was anxious to get the customer out of the store so he could get home. There was a storm coming, and the weather radio had been saying the possibility of tornadoes was high. Ronnie was like everyone else in Elizabeth. He didn't get too worked up about storms, but this one felt different somehow. Ronnie said he couldn't explain it. He felt uneasy, and like he needed to get home to me and Mom and Marin before the bad weather hit. But he'd gotten delayed, and by the time he'd hit the highway, it was too late. "I could see it from the road," he told me, the two of us sitting in shadows in our motel room. Neither of us had bothered to turn on the light. Neither of us would bother to turn it on for the whole next day, either. I think we were each afraid to see the other, afraid that our brokenness would become contagious if we shined light on it. "I've seen videos of tornadoes before, but Jersey, I've never seen anything like this. It was huge. Had all these little tornadoes circling it, too. The thing was so big it looked like it could swallow the whole world."
It did, I thought.
It swallowed my whole world. But I didn't say anything aloud. I sat on my bed, staring at the wallpaper across the room, unsure whether the design was pineapples or diamonds, and listened.
"I tried to beat it home, I really did," he said. "But it kind of veered off toward me and I had to stop the truck. Everybody was stopping their cars in the middle of the highway and running as fast as they could to the underpass, so that's where I went to."
He shifted forward, resting his elbows on his knees so that his words fell directly to the floor.
"It never went over us, but I could feel it. The wind, I mean. It was so loud. And it had, I don't know, a smell to it, like electricity or something."
Immediately, I was taken back to my spot under the pool table. The wind roaring around me, tugging at my clothes, my hair, like it was alive.
"I keep thinking about your mom," he said. "And Marin."
And once again, he was choked with sobs, as he had been off and on since I'd come up behind him in the wreckage of his bedroom.
"They must have been so scared."
Rescuers had found them yesterday, not too far from where Colby and I had been standing. Apparently, when the storm had started rolling in, Janice had decided that their building was too full of windows to be safe. And since it had no basement, everyone had rushed across the street to Fenderman's Grocery. Ronnie said he thought maybe they were hoping to get into the milk cooler. but they didn't make it in time. Janice and three others survived. Three of the moms had crawled out of the downed building, crying weakly for help. Janice had not yet regained consciousness. None of the little girls in Marin's class made it. Not one. According to Ronnie, rescuers rushed to Fenderman's grocery right away, picking through the massive bulk under the curtain of rain, until the one remaining emergency siren, the one too far on the other end of town for us to hear on our end, cranked up another tornado warning and they'd been forced to take cover. In the morning, after the sun came out and only hours before Colby and I were trekking toward 6th Street, a crowd of helpers, including my stepdad, fell on Fenderman's again. They found 11 employees, alive and well, wedged inside one of the walk-ins. And in the aisles heading toward the walk-ins, they'd found everyone else, including Mom and Marin, who were buried under a massive shelf of canned goods. Marin's hands were over her ears, Ronnie said. Mom had been lying over her, trying to protect her. I thought about all the times I'd told Marin that the storm was fine, that it was only noise, that it couldn't hurt her as long as she was inside. I wondered if she'd remembered I'd told her those things. I wondered if she'd died feeling like I'd lied to her. Is the noise fine, Jersey? Is it over? Yes, Marin, you'll be fine. It's just noise.
Dance the East Coast Swing with me, Jersey. Miss Janice taught us. It's fun.
No, go away. You're blocking the TV.
But the noise.
It's fine. Just go. Three moms had made it out, but none of them were my mom. It seemed impossible that the same wind that had left my fragile porcelain kitten untouched could have destroyed the flesh and bone of my mother.
Where are they now?
I asked Ronnie, closing my eyes. The stupid wallpaper design had imprinted itself into my eyelids, purple blobs against the black.
At the morgue, he said. I went to the hospital, but it was chaos in there. So many people, and a lot of people still missing, so I went home and you weren't there. I had no idea where you were, and I thought maybe you'd gone with your mom and sister to dance class. So I went back to Fenderman's to try and find you. I didn't know what else to do.
I was looking for them, too, I said, a big tear rolling down my cheek. In my mind flashed 1,000 images. Images of my mom and me, all the fun things we did. All the times she made me feel special and loved and happy.
Images of Marin, who was so sweet and innocent, and who I resented for being the baby, even though I knew it wasn't her fault.
She looked up to me and wanted me to accept her as a person. She wanted me to say she was cool. She wanted me to look up to her, too. I realized that the worst part of someone you love dying suddenly isn't the saying goodbye part. It's the part where you wonder if they knew how much you loved them. It's the part where you hope you said and did enough good stuff to make up for the bad stuff. It's the part where there are no second chances. No going back, no more opportunities to tell them how you feel about them. At some point I drifted off, and though I woke a few times to the coarse sobs of my stepdad in the bed next to mine, I slept better than I had in 2 days. I'd showered and changed into the clothes I'd picked up at home. I'd used the toilet and had eaten a hamburger that Ronnie had fetched for me, and it felt like forever since I had been in a bed. But when I woke in the morning, I was no longer confused about where I was. I was no longer waking up to those blissful 30 seconds or so of forgetting about the tornado. I was aware of it from the very moment I opened my eyes. It was all I could think about. On the third day, Ronnie was gone when I awoke. He'd left a note, along with a box of donuts, saying he was at the house and would be stopping by the hospital later. There was a part of me that wished he'd asked me if I wanted to go too, but then I decided I didn't want to go back to the house. Ever. There were too many memories there.
Memories of things I knew I would never get back. I would never again listen to Mom singing along to the radio while washing dishes or hear Marin laugh over some dumb slapstick stunt on one of her favorite cartoons.
I would never again put towels in that dryer or crumble hamburger in a skillet to have dinner ready after dance. Those things were gone, and I didn't want to find them. But the hospital. Ronnie was also going to the hospital. Why hadn't he asked if I wanted to go too? Would they let me see Mom and Marin? Would I be able to look if they did? I ached so hard to lay eyes on them, even if the thought of identifying dead bodies freaked me out, made my limbs go tingly with fear. When my phone was fully charged, I texted Colby. You make it to Milton? He answered right away.
Yes. Where are you? You safe?
At motel in Prairie Valley with Ronnie.
Your mom?
I gripped the phone against my chest, unsure if my fingers could type out the words. In the end, I settled on only one. No. There was a long silence before my phone vibrated with his response.
God, I'm sorry.
Thanks. Me too, I typed back.
What are you gonna do?
He asked. It was my turn to pause. I still couldn't wrap my head around what life would be like with just Ronnie and me. It seemed like it would be so silent and depressing and impossible. I don't know, I typed.
Keep me posted, okay? Let me know if you need anything.
Yep, I answered. And I knew I could. The tornado had ripped so much away from me, but I still had Colby. I was grateful to at least have that much, to at least have someone to lean on. Ronnie didn't come home until it was dusk outside, and I spent the entire day in bed, alternately watching news footage about the tornado and drifting off in fitful naps where I dreamed about my friends, all bloodied and battered and wondering why I hadn't died along with them. The tornado's path was much easier to get a grip on by watching aerial coverage. They said it was nearly 8 miles long and 2 miles wide. They said the downtown area, the area of Fenderman's Grocery and Mace Tools and Janice's dance studio, was hit the worst and was where most of the victims were found. They estimated more than 120 dead, and lots of people were still missing. With every minute that someone wasn't found, the prognosis looked worse and worse. If those who were still trapped didn't die from their injuries, they could die from dehydration instead. Every few minutes, victims would appear before the camera, recounting what they'd gone through. Some of them still looked shell-shocked. Others didn't appear to be taking it so seriously. Almost all of them had lost nearly everything they had. Despite myself, I scanned the crowds behind the people on camera, hoping for a glimpse of my mom or my sister. I knew that Ronnie had seen them at Fenderman's, had pulled them out of the rubble himself, but still a part of me wanted to believe that they might have survived, that Ronnie had been in shock and he was wrong about what he'd seen. Maybe he'd found two other people who just happened to resemble Mom and Marin. Doppelgangers. Happened all the time. I also scanned the faces for signs of Jane and Annie, especially when the news showed footage of the high school, which had been ripped nearly in two. The newscasters said the tornado appeared to have skipped right down the middle of the field house. People had left flowers and teddy bears and notes on the front lawn. But nobody said whether anyone in the high school had lived or died. God, what would I do if Jane and Danny had died, too? I pushed the thought away and tried instead to focus on an old sitcom rerun, but within a few minutes my mind wandered to the tragedy that was our town, and I flipped the news on again. When Ronnie came back, he didn't say a word to me. He barged through the door, letting it slam shut behind him, and walked straight to the bathroom. "You see them?" I asked as he passed me by. But he didn't answer. He disappeared into the bathroom, and seconds later I heard the shower hiss to life. "You see them?" I asked again when he came back out of the shower, wearing a pair of shorts I didn't recognize. But he only fell face first onto his bed, pulled the blankets up around his ears, and within minutes was snoring. I blinked at the TV, wondering whether I should turn it off. I hadn't eaten since the donuts he'd left for breakfast, and my stomach was growling. "Ronnie?" I asked a couple of times, my voice sounding very loud in the small room, even though it felt like I was whispering. He was exhausted, physically and emotionally. I understood, or at least I tried to, because if I let myself think about how physically and emotionally tired I was, if I let myself feel it, I might pass out too. I would sleep for days. I gathered the change he'd left on the night table and got some chips out of a vending machine for dinner, then fell asleep too. The next day, Ronnie didn't get out of bed at all. He moaned and turned over when I said his name, then pulled the dingy blanket up to cover his head. I was running out of change, so I dug his wallet out of the pants he'd left, puddled on the bathroom floor, and used his credit card to order a pizza. I saved him half, but he never got up to eat it. For most of the afternoon, I watched TV coverage, but it was getting spottier as news crews found new tragedies to focus on. I decided to try Jane and Danny. I went down to the motel lobby and sank into the ratty couch so I could talk without having to worry about waking up Ronnie. I dialed Jane's cell, but it rang and rang. Either the call didn't go through or she wasn't answering. I refused to think of the third option, that it might be buried with her under our broken high school. I hung up, then called Danny. She answered on the second ring.
"Oh my God, Jersey!" she cried. "Are you okay? Where are you?"
My stomach fluttered with relief, and immediately tears squeezed out onto my cheeks.
"You're okay,"
I breathed, which I knew didn't answer either of her questions, but those were the only words that would come out.
"Yeah, I'm fine. He pretty much missed our house. Broke all the windows in my brother's car, though. Where are you?"
"At a motel with Ronnie."
"Did you see the school?"
"Yeah, it's trashed. They said there won't be any more school this year, obviously, so it's summer break now."
"What a crappy way to start summer break."
"You hear anything from Jane?"
"No."
"You?"
"No.
A lot of people still can't get cell service. I tried to call you, by the way, but it wouldn't go through. But everybody I've heard from seems to be pretty much the same. Freaked out, lost all their stuff. I'm glad you guys made it through okay."
I paused, blinking rapidly. I opened my mouth, but my throat felt closed tight.
"We didn't. We didn't make it through okay at all."
"What about Colby?"
I took a deep breath, steadied myself.
"He's fine. He went to Milton. But, Danny, I have to tell you something."
I paused again, unsure of how to say it.
I'd never had to give anyone bad news before, not like this. And I wasn't sure how you eased into it.
Instead, I blurted it out, my mouth working faster than my brain.
"My mom died, and so did Marin."
There was such utter silence on the other end of the line, I could hear myself breathing into the speaker. When Danny spoke again, her voice was barely more than a whisper.
"Are you serious?"
I nodded, unable to speak, even though I knew she couldn't hear me nodding and I felt stupid, but there was nothing I could do to stop it. The words wouldn't come out.
"Oh my God, Jersey, I don't know what to say."
There was a long, wrenching silence.
"I'm so sorry."
"So, yeah, we're in Prairie Valley right now," I said, swallowing, trying to get control of myself and get as far away from the word "died" as possible. "I don't know when we'll be back home. Our house is pretty much gone."
"I know. We drove around a little last night. My mom wanted to take pictures so she could send them to my grandma in Indiana. I guess all those houses have to be rebuilt. Is Ronnie going to rebuild yours?"
"I don't know. He isn't talking." Danny's voice went soft.
"Yeah, I guess he's pretty messed up right now. I can't believe they died. Do you know when the funerals will be?"
"No, Ronnie isn't talking about anything. He's not even getting out of bed." I considered telling her that I had been stealing money out of his pants so I could eat, and that I was wearing the same underwear I'd been wearing when the tornado hit, and that I was starting to get scared that he would never get out of bed, and that I would starve to death or something stupid because I was too numb to think of how I could save myself. But I didn't want to worry her any more than I already had, so I let the silence sit between us again.
"Listen," she finally said. "I'd have to ask my mom, but if you need to come stay with us, at least until the funerals are over, I'm sure it would be okay with her. We don't have any power, and our roof is leaking in like 10 places, but they're going to fix it today, and they're saying we might get power back by the end of the week, maybe."
Part of me wanted to jump at the chance.
I wanted to tell Danny to come get me right now. Wanted to hop in her car and let her mom soothe everything the way my mom would have done if she had just stayed home. If she had just skipped Marin's dance class. I would borrow Danny's clothes and be happy to wear something that smelled like fabric softener rather than sweat and rainwater, even though she was easily two sizes smaller than I was. I would eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, thick on the peanut butter, and drink endless sodas, even if they were warm and I had to eat by candlelight. But I couldn't do it. I kept thinking about how much Mom loved Ronnie, and how disappointed she would be in me if I left him, stinking up the bedsheets and mopping his unwashed face with the pillow, starving himself to death because he wouldn't get up to eat. Even if I'd never had a deep connection with Ronnie, Mom had loved him like mad, and I couldn't leave him because Mom wouldn't want me to. Okay, thanks. I'll tell Ronnie. Just call me. I will. I should go. If you hear from Jane, let me know, okay? Of course. I'm sure she's fine. You shouldn't worry. Yeah, I said. But how did we know? Not everyone came out of the tornado fine. I didn't come out fine at all.
And yours?
Huh.
Let me know when the funerals are. I want to come.
I squeezed my eyes tighter. A tear slipped out and down one cheek. Burying my mother and my sister seemed like something I just couldn't do. I wasn't strong enough. I wanted my mom. I needed her. How desperately ironic that the one person I needed to give me strength to face my mom's death was the one who died. I will. I hung up and sat with the phone in my lap for a few minutes, staring at the water that dripped off the bottom of the window air conditioner into a plastic tub on the floor.
You okay?
The desk clerk asked, leaning over the counter to peer at me. She twisted her watch around on her wrist anxiously. I nodded. Fine. A lie. I got up and started to walk toward the door.
It's real terrible what happened over there in Elizabeth, she said.
Yeah.
I'm real sorry about it.
Thanks. I hurried out of the office as quickly as I could. I didn't want to hear anyone else tell me they were sorry. What did I'm sorry mean exactly when someone had died? Wouldn't it be much more accurate to say, I'm grateful, when someone close to you was hit by a tragedy? I'm grateful, as in, I'm grateful that this didn't happen to me. At least that would be honest. I stood outside and looked up at the sky. The day was sunny and warm again, and here, 20 miles away from home, it almost seemed like a normal day. Except on a normal day, I would be in chem class right now, excited about theater club practice and the lighting cues I still had to learn. On a normal day, I would be seeing Mom tonight, would be telling Marin that I was too busy, always too busy. I gazed down the line of motel room doors. Behind one of those, Ronnie was drowning in his own grief. Behind one of them, he was alone, and I was alone, only feet apart, unable to talk about the things we needed to say. I couldn't go in there, not yet. Instead, I turned and walked down the sidewalk, Ronnie's credit card in my pocket. I wandered past a strip mall, which was filled with real estate offices and computer repair shops and dry cleaners, and headed toward a big chain pharmacy a short distance away. My clothes and shoes felt coarse and gross against my skin. I gazed at all the perfect buildings, the perfect people. Why had they been spared? I stopped at the pharmacy and filled a cart with packages of ugly underwear and socks that normally I wouldn't be caught dead in, t-shirts and flip-flops emblazoned with the logo and mascot of a high school I'd never attended, and packs of chips and cookies and cups of Easy Mac. I stood for a long time in front of the cold section, letting the refrigeration fall over me in waves, closing my eyes and soaking it up until my arms were goosebumpy and tight. After I had bought as much as I could carry, I walked back to the motel, shopping bags looped over my arms, wondering how I was going to lure Ronnie out of bed. What would Mom want me to do? If Ronnie and I had been closer, maybe I would know, but Mom had always been the buffer between us, had always been the one trying to bridge a relationship where there really wasn't one. You can call him Dad, you know,
she'd said one night, not long after they got married. He's technically your dad now. My dad lives in Castor City, I'd said, my bulbous 10-year-old belly sticking out under the bottom of my shirt. That man, my mom had said, her eyes fiery and narrow, was never a dad. A dad doesn't just abandon his child. Ronnie would never be that kind of dad. I knew she was right, of course. And it wasn't like I had any deep connection with my so-called dad in Castor City. Even by the time I was 10, I couldn't remember what my real father looked like. I didn't have one single memory of the two of us together. But I always kept Ronnie at a distance anyway. Maybe being abandoned by my real dad was why I'd always kept Ronnie at arm's distance. How many dads was I going to give the chance to hurt me? I stood outside the room for a few seconds, key card in hand, while I took a deep, readying breath. But when I pushed the door open, Ronnie's unmade bed was empty. The bathroom door was open, the light out. He wasn't in there either. Relieved, I shut the door and hustled to the bathroom myself, anxious to put on some clean underwear and then eat a quiet dinner by the TV. It wasn't until somewhere around 3 a.m. when I woke to find the TV still on and Ronnie's bed still empty that I began to wonder where he might have gone. Chapter 11. Ronnie didn't return until late the next day. I squinted, sitting cross-legged on my bed playing cards, and held my hand up to shield my face from the strip of sunlight that flooded the room when he opened the door. "Where were you?" I asked. He let the door close behind him and turned to open the curtains. The heat of the afternoon sun blazed through the window onto my bed.
"You need to get your stuff together," he said.
I gathered the cards and dropped them into their box. He paused for a second at the foot of my bed, as if he was going to say something, the lines deep in his face and shaded by the several days' beard he had grown. There were bags under his eyes, and he had a smell about him that I recognized as stale alcohol. But he only stared at the bedspread uncomfortably and then moved on toward the bathroom. I heard him unwrap a plastic cup and turn on the faucet.
"Why?" I said. "Where are we going?"
The water ran for a while longer, and then he reappeared, the edges of his hair damp as if he'd splashed water on his face. He let out a sigh.
"Listen, Jersey, I don't know how to say this," he said.
But then he didn't say any more. He sank down on his bed, sitting with his back to me.
"Say what?"
I finally prompted, turning and letting my legs dangle over the edge of the bed.
"What's going on? Is it the funerals? Are they today?"
"I don't know about the funerals. Stop asking me about the goddamn funerals."
He smacked the bed. A muffled whoomp. He took another breath, wiped his face.
I can't even think about it," he said more softly. "I can't think about anything. The funerals, the house, you. Every day I wake up and there's all these things to do and I can't even get my head around them."
I wanted to get up and go to him, sit next to him, wrap my arms around him and tell him how much I missed them too. I knew it was what my mom would want, for me to comfort him, and for him to comfort me, for us to be there for each other. But I stayed put, staring at his back, at his hunched shoulders and blackened elbows, and the ragged hole in his T-shirt, that same invisible barrier keeping me at a distance.
"We've got to have the funeral sometime, though," I said. "We can't just let them rot in the morgue."
"I know what needs to be done," he said. "But it isn't that easy. I've lost everything important to me."
I slipped my big toe along the bumpy inside of my flip-flop. "Almost," I amended for him. "I've lost almost everything important to me." But I knew he'd said what he meant. He'd lost Mom and Marin. The important things. He was as stuck with me as I was with him.
"I did, too," I said instead.
He finally turned to face me.
"I got hold of your grandparents, Billy and Harold Cameron."
I frowned in confusion.
"The ones down in Castor City," he
he added.
I know, I said. I know who they are.
They were my father's parents, the only grandparents I had, and Ronnie knew that all too well. Mom's parents had disowned her. In all my life, I'd never heard her talk about them, unless one of us asked a specific question. But she'd talked about Billy and Harold Cameron. I don't remember ever seeing them, and I never once got a birthday card or a Christmas gift from them, but I knew who they were in a vague sort of way. I knew that Mom disliked them. She thought they were cold as reptiles, and they'd probably gotten that way by being screwed over by their own kids so many times. I knew that she blamed them in part for my father leaving us, but that she'd kind of felt sorry for them, too, because all they ever did was clean up their kids' messes, and they never had any enjoyment of their own. She said they seemed depressed and jaded, like life and everyone in it was out to get them.
You told them about Mom? Why?
He finally raised his tired, bloodshot eyes to meet mine, which made my shoulders shrink and my stomach slip.
Jersey, I'm sorry, he said.
And that was pretty much all he needed to say. I got it from just those three words.
But why?
He spread his hands apart, and I got some satisfaction from seeing them shake, from seeing his chin quiver and the string of saliva that connected his top tooth to his bottom lip.
I can't do it. I can't raise you alone. I never meant to...
Call me your daughter, my mind supplied. And that right there was the reason I could never embrace Ronnie as my dad. It had nothing to do with being abandoned by my drunk father down in Castor City. It was a barrier that neither of us could acknowledge, but that we both knew was there. Ronnie never intended to call me his daughter. I was simply part of the package deal he got when he married my mom.
So, they're coming up here to help you, is that it?
He shook his head miserably.
They're gonna take you down there.
What? I don't want to go down there. I want to stay here. I was planning to help you rebuild. I don't need some vacation from the storm.
It's not a visit. They're taking you to Castor City to live with them.
No they're not, I said, standing suddenly. No way.
You don't have a choice.
But why? I can help you. We can help each other. You're overwhelmed right now. We both are, but it'll get better. Besides, my friends are all up here. I can't just leave them. I need them.
You need a mother, and I can't give you that, he said.
Billy Cameron isn't my mother. Mom was my mother. She's gone, and I'll never have another mother, and sending me off to live with strangers isn't going to change that.
It's the only option you've got, he said.
I moved toward him, reaching for him.
No, it's not. It's not an option at all. I want to stay here. I want to stay with you. Please, Ronnie, don't make me go live with them. I don't even know them.
I'm sorry,
he said and turned onto his side, his face smushed against the ugly bedspread. He said something else, but it was too muffled for me to make out. I turned and looked around frantically. For what, I didn't know. I felt like I needed to do something that would show him what a bad idea this was. Something that would make him change his mind.
Please, Ronnie, no, I don't want to go, please, I begged, kneeling by the side of his bed, but he stayed with his face buried, spewing unintelligible noises into the polyfiber. I'm not going, I cried, trying to sound defiant, but knowing that I had no real threat to make. I had no money, no stuff, no other family to turn to. You can't make me do this!
Finally, Ronnie sat up and wiped his eyes.
I'm sorry, he said, calmer now. I don't want this, but I don't want to take care of you right now. I know that sounds horrible and makes me a bad person, but I can't help it. It's how I feel. I don't know what to do with you, except this.
Mom would hate it.
My jaw ached from being clenched so hard.
She would hate you for doing it.
Your mother would understand.
No, she wouldn't. She would never understand why you would send me to live with them.
I'm sending you to someone who can take better care of you than I can. She would want that.
I stood.
She wouldn't.
They'll be here in a few minutes, so you should get your things together,
he answered. Anxiety washed over me. A few minutes? There was no way I'd convince him this was a horrible idea in just a few minutes. Of course, he probably knew that, which was why he had waited to tell me. My mind raced, trying to think of an offer, a deal, anything I could do to change this. But I came up with nothing. Fine, I said, bending to gather what few items I had and stomping across the room to stuff them into my backpack. Wait, I froze. They're coming now? What about the funerals? He looked down at the floor, smashing his lips together.
I'm sorry, Jersey, was all he said. Again. Fury engulfed me. He was sorry? I was going to miss the funerals because he was too selfish and cowardly to let me stay with him, and he was sorry?
You can't be serious. You can't actually be thinking it's okay to send me away before I get to say goodbye to my mother and my sister. At this, my voice cracked, and tears started anew. How could you do that?
I don't know when the funerals are going to be. I can't even make myself go to the hospital or talk to the funeral home. I don't know where I'll get the money. We'll have a memorial later, after I get things figured out.
The right thing to do would be to let me help you figure out those things, not send me away. I didn't get to say goodbye, Ronnie. I didn't get to tell them. I pressed my lips together, unable to go on. There was so much I hadn't gotten to tell them. So much I wanted to. So much I should have been able to. But who was I kidding? Saying any of those things at their funerals wasn't the same as saying them to my mother and sister. They were already gone. I'd already missed my chance.
I'm sure Billy and Harold will bring you up for it, he said.
I can't believe you're doing this to me. I hate you, I said, and I meant it with every fiber of my body. Ronnie slunk off to the bathroom and turned on the shower. Desperate, I reached for my cell phone and dialed Danny.
Hey, she said, I was just thinking about you.
Glad someone is, I said. I need your help.
What's going on?
He's sending me away, I cried.
Who is? Sending you where?
I pressed my forehead against the wallpaper.
Pineapples. How weird.
Feeling like I couldn't breathe. Ronnie, he's sending me to live with my grandparents in Castor City.
No way. For how long?
I don't know. Forever, I think, I said. He says he can't take care of me. Help me, Danny.
He can't send you away forever, she said. Can he? Is that, like, legal?
I don't think he cares. I mean, they're technically my family, so it probably is, but I don't want to go. You've got to help me. Let me stay with you. Ask your mom.
She's not home. You want me to call her?
Yes, I said. But deep down, I knew by the time she got a hold of her mom and called me back with an answer, it would be too late. They would have already come and taken me. I would be on my way to Castor City with people who were, according to my mom, cold as reptiles. I hung up and continued to stuff things into my bag. I pulled out my Western Civ book and my math binder and threw them in the trash, keeping only Bless the Beasts and Children, hint, hint, ladies and gentlemen, and a few pencils and pens. I rolled up the few clothes I had and crammed them inside the bag, cradling the porcelain kitten I'd brought from home. I pulled out Marin's purse, running my fingers lightly over the fake leather. I sat with it on my lap and waited, bitterly watching the TV rerun more footage of the tornado destruction. What the news crews couldn't show was the real damage Elizabeth's monster tornado had left behind. How do you record the wreckage left in someone's heart? I pulled out a piece of gum and popped it into my mouth, then smoothed out the foil. I found a pen on the nightstand and drew a picture of a big stick figure holding a little stick figure. Marin has a dad, I wrote beneath the picture, and then folded the foil into a tiny square and added it to the stash. Marin has a dad. Even in her death, she has a dad. But I don't. I never did. Chapter 12. As predicted, My grandparents arrived before Danny called back. She'd texted, "Mom not picking up, we'll keep trying," but it was too late to save me. I refused to answer the knock on the door, forcing Ronnie to get up. He could send me away, but I wasn't going to make it easy for him. We hadn't spoken since I told him I hated him. I didn't know if he was staying silent in an attempt to make me feel guilty, but if so, it wasn't working. If I'd been the one who died with Mom in the tornado, he would never have turned Marin out. He would never have sent her to live with strangers in a strange city. He opened the door, and a white-haired woman with a face as wrinkled and tan as a tree trunk stepped inside. "She ready?" she said, talking about me rather than to me as if I weren't sitting right there. Ronnie nodded, and she turned toward me. "You got things?"
"Only a few," Ronnie interjected. "We lost everything in the storm."
"Yes, you told me on the phone," she said. No softness, no tenderness in her voice. As much as I'd gotten tired of hearing everyone tell me how sorry they were, this was worse. It was like she didn't care at all, like she was here to pick up an unwanted couch. All business.
"Harold's in the car," she said, raising her voice. "You eatin'? He'd like to hit the diner on the way out."
"I'm not hungry," I muttered, forcing myself to stand up. I searched Ronnie with my eyes as I walked past him, hoping he would change his mind. I would forgive him if he let me stay. It would hurt, but I'd pretend he'd never called them. I'd try to understand. But he simply looked down at his feet and let me pass. I followed Grandmother Billy, who didn't so much walk with me as walk determinedly ahead of me, her step as steady as a warden's. And I realized that was what this felt like, being led to a jail cell, my freedom stolen. Actually, this felt worse than prison. At least in prison, my friends could visit me. I'd already lost Mom and Marin. Now I was losing Danny, Colby, Jane, everyone I knew, everything that was familiar to me. What else could possibly be taken from me? We approached an old, mostly rust and maroon car, idling at the curb. Grandfather Harold sitting behind the wheel, squinting in the sun. He pushed a button on the dash with a fat finger and the trunk popped open.
"You want to put your bags in?"
Grandmother Billy asked, lifting the trunk lid all the way.
I shook my head, squeezing Marin's purse closer to my side. The thought of lowering the pocketbook she loved into the motor oil-scented trunk on top of a tangled snake of jumper cables felt too much like ripping out my lungs and jumping up and down on them. I opened the back door and slid inside the car, which also smelled like oil, mixed with something more organic. Grass? Skin? I couldn't tell. Grandfather Harold lifted his chin once to acknowledge me, and my stomach clenched with fear as he put the car into drive, Grandmother Billy slamming the trunk and easing herself into the passenger seat in front of me. I didn't want to go. "Please, Ronnie," I begged inside my head, "come out and get me. Make it like the movies where at the last minute the girl is loved after all and gets saved by the hero. Be the hero, Ronnie." But our motel room door had slowly swung shut, closing the space between me and the last familiar thing in my life. He didn't even wave goodbye.
"She ain't hungry," my grandmother said, her blunt fingers working to find the seatbelt as my grandfather pulled away from the curb and into traffic.
"Well, I don't suppose she has to eat," he mumbled.
"She's just gonna sit there?"
"If that's what she wants to do. As long as she knows we ain't stopping halfway down to Joplin for anything. She don't eat, she don't eat."
"Well, we can't let her starve to death."
I chewed my lip and listened to them argue about me as if I were invisible. We navigated way too slowly toward the highway. If Grandfather Harold was going to insist on driving like this, we would never get to Castor City. Which would be fine with me. I stared out the window and thought about the time Mom had taken Marin and me to Branson for an all-girls weekend. I'd watched the fields roll by, thinking that southern Missouri was so many worlds away from Elizabeth. As we passed Castor City and the landscape changed, the Ozark Mountains bursting around us, looking untouched and untamed,
I had felt so far away from home. I remembered that there had been a dead, flattened scorpion behind the curtains in our cabin, and I'd freaked out, refusing to step down off the couch until Mom had checked the whole cabin over. But Marin had been fascinated by the bug.
"It's got poison?"
she kept asking, and when Mom would answer, "I don't know, honey, some scorpions are poisonous," Marin would crouch low, her butt hanging inches from the floor, her bare toes pushed into the nap of the carpet, cords of her hair dangling down past her knees, and would stare at it. A few seconds later, she would look up.
"Is it the poison kind?"
And Mom, checking under a couch cushion or in the linen closet, would absently repeat, "I don't know, honey." At one point, Marin was crouched so low, her nose was between her knees, and I couldn't help myself. I tiptoed off the couch and snuck up behind her.
"It moved! It moved!"
I shrieked, bumping her in the back with my knees and making her pitch forward. Marin had shrieked, catching herself just short of falling over, and had shot straight up and run out of the room, bawling her eyes out while I laughed.
"Really, Jersey, did you have to?"
Mom said, exasperatedly chasing after my sister. Marin had spent the whole rest of the weekend terrified, crying and running from every bug she saw. Sitting in the back seat of my grandfather's car, heading toward the part of the state where I'd seen my first and only scorpion, I thought about how I'd done that to her. I'd taken away her fascination and replaced it with fear. She'd died scared of bugs because that's how I'd shaped her. Without thinking, I reached into her purse and pulled out another stick of gum, cramming it into my mouth with the first. I spread the foil out on my knee and drew a picture of a stick figure crouched over a little black blotch on the ground. "Marin loves scorpions," I wrote. I liked that truth better. I folded up the foil and dropped it in with the others, then leaned my head against the window and closed my eyes so I wouldn't have to see the chain stores and strip malls fade away into the fields and farms that were to become my new reality. Neither of my grandparents bothered to shake me awake. Instead, they relied on the slamming of their doors, whoomp, whoomp, to alert me that we'd stopped. I lifted my head from the window, wiping my damp cheek on my shoulder, and blinked the parking lot into focus. My grandfather had come around the car and was standing next to my grandmother, both of them staring at the doors of a grungy-looking diner. After a few seconds, my grandmother turned and bent to look in the car window.
"You coming in?"
she said, her voice muffled by the closed window. I didn't answer, didn't move, wasn't sure how to do either one. So she simply nodded once and turned away. Together, they walked into the restaurant without me. I shook my head and gave a disgusted little snort. I didn't want to go inside. I wasn't hungry. My stomach was too tied in knots to even think about eating. And I really didn't want to have to try to make conversation over dinner with these two people. But it had been days since I'd had any sort of real meal, and I knew that now it was up to me to make sure I did things like eat and shower and sleep. Nobody else was going to care. My grandparents were sitting at a table near the restrooms, side by side, their shoulders touching. Who does that? I thought. What couple doesn't sit across from each other so they can talk? But then I decided that I was just as happy it wouldn't be my shoulder grazing against one of theirs, and I slid into the chair across from my grandmother.
"We already ordered,"
she said by way of greeting, but the waitress had appeared carrying two glasses of iced tea.